the uniforms, to cook the food, to run the entire facility for a wage of $1 a day, the way they compel that labor is through withholding visitation rights. So if you refuse to work, you get to see your family, your loved ones once every 2 weeks. But if you participate in this basically forced labor program, then you get to see your loved ones once a week. And I remember when Marco emerged from the detention center, that was the first thing he was talking about. I think he sort of learned that inside. I learned it from him, and it was shocking. And today it is the subject of a lawsuit.
The Infiltrators co-director Alex Rivera and immigrant rights activists Viridiana Martinez and Mohamed Abdullahi. The Infiltrators will be screened at the Miami Film Festival on Tuesday, and then starting Friday at South by Southwest in Austin, Texas. And that does it for the show. A very fond farewell to Ariel Boone. We will miss your passion, your dedication, your wisdom, and your puns, Punderdome star. You have made Democracy Now! So much better. I'm speaking in Denver March 15th at East High School. Check our website. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue in Portland. The Personnel Committee will meet on the second Monday of each month at 6 p.m.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time chief engineer. Applications are due by midnight on Monday, March 4th, to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, or by emailing engineerhire@kboo.fm. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regards to the minimum qualifications and by answering the following question: why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019.
The time is 5:01 p.m. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next is the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Trump has told 9,014 lies to date.
We talk about the fighter wing of the Oregon National Guard.
And in Newport Beach, California, high school kids make a swastika out of red plastic cups.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 4th, 2019. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Thousands turned out yesterday for the Portland Women's March. Organizer Ilona Wilson spoke with KBOO News this afternoon about what's next.
Well, I was absolutely just amazed by the amount of all different kinds of women that showed up and that marched and vowed to take action. It was more than we could have ever imagined it being as we were planning it. So I think it was an absolute success.
What is your long-term goal? What do you want to see flowing from this event in the future?
Yeah, so flowing from this event, I was really hoping that this would just reignite the women's movement that has been going on for a long time, long before I was even born, and really start to bring women together and working together and within the smaller communities in Portland. Moving forward, I'd like to be doing listening sessions in different parts of the community to hear what women are really concerned about and to take that concern and put it into action. And that's going to be really exciting, as well as hosting workshops. So getting prepared for the following March.
Excellent, because my next question was, how can people connect with you now? And what do you hope to do in the very near future?
Yeah, so people can connect with us, Women's March, that either, I'm so sorry, my nephews are here, I apologize. They can either, they can email, they can find our information on our website. So it's Women's March PDX, and that's with an X instead of an E. And they can do that, or, you know, we always answer calls too. And I love being able to give out my personal one. So folks are definitely able, if they want to get interested, to text, call, and I would love to help them get involved in whatever it is that they're passionate about.
That was Ilona Wilson speaking with KBOO's Lisa Loving. Reach the Women's March organizers at 503-752-6715.
In a release issued over the weekend, the Vancouver Police Department identified the officers who shot and killed a man last Thursday. The officers involved in the shooting are Christopher Duville, age 34, and Andrew Dunbar, age 28. Both officers were put on leave, which is standard procedure. The victim, 29-year-old Michael Eugene Pierce, was standing at the corner of West 12th and Jefferson in Vancouver when he was shot after reportedly waving a gun and shouting at passing motorists. Molly Wickenhagen, a community member who knew Pierce, said he was living on the streets and had a history of mental illness. According to family members, Pierce was diagnosed with paranoid schizophrenia as a teenager, but had stopped taking his prescribed medication. Pierce was the father of a 5-year-old daughter. Police said the regional major crimes team is investigating the incident, which is the second Vancouver police shooting in the past 2 weeks.
The Civil Rights Code of Portland has been extended to include protections for atheists, agnostics, and other non-believers. The code already has anti-discrimination protections on the basis of race, religion, gender, and national origin. The amendment was approved unanimously and will go into effect on March 29th. Under the new rules, employees who experience discrimination on the basis of non-religious beliefs can sue or file a complaint against their employer. Portland is the second city, by the way, to provide such protections. Madison, Wisconsin was the first.
The Idaho Supreme Court ruled today that individuals have the right to sue if they think someone implied something defamatory but didn't say it outright. Former teacher James Verity sued several media outlets, including KGW Television in Portland, after they reported on a national investigation showing teachers who lost licenses in one state were often able to move to another state to be licensed there. Verity was a subject in the story who lost his Oregon teaching license but was later able to obtain a license in Idaho. The unanimous Idaho Supreme Court said there was no proof the media outlets actually defamed Verity by implication and ordered the claims against them dropped, but the High Court said a jury should decide if KGW or two other networks who aired similar but less descriptive versions of the news story violated the standard.
Oregon continues to spend millions of dollars to settle lawsuits. The Statesman Journal reports today that in 2018, Oregon officials paid $15.24 million to resolve legal claims. Those settlements are paid through the Oregon Department of Administrative Services Self-Insurance Fund. The department's risk management office bills state agencies every 2 years for, quote, risk charges, which are collected and put into the fund. This year's settlements are less than last year's $12.58 million to settle claims. In 2016, the state paid out $22 million in lawsuit settlements.
Oregon officials say elder abuse is on the rise, especially financial scams. This week, a coalition of organizations came together across the state to raise awareness of the crimes, which often go unreported because they so often involve close family members. Elder financial abuse reports go up every year, according to the Oregon Department of Human Services. Carmel Snyder with the American Association of Retired People says reported financial abuse of elders is likely, quote, just the tip of the iceberg in terms of total number of older adults who are defrauded or scammed out of their life savings. Tax scams are the most common form of elder theft. Officials remind consumers the Internal Revenue Service, quote, does not initiate contact with taxpayers by email, text message, or social media channels to request personal or financial information. Nationally, an estimated $2.9 billion is stolen from elderly people annually, usually by someone close to the victim.
House Democrats plan to introduce legislation reinstating net neutrality rules that were repealed by the FCC under the Trump regime. The Republican-controlled Senate actually voted to reinstate net neutrality last spring, but the effort went nowhere when the House of Representatives failed to address the issue. In other good news, major internet providers have not made any changes in how Americans access the internet since the repeal.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native women gathered at the New Mexico Legislature Friday for Indigenous Women's Day to honor missing and murdered Indigenous women and girls. Native women's advocates and state lawmakers were among speakers at the event. A bill involving missing and murdered Indigenous women passed the New Mexico Senate Friday. It supports U.S. New Mexico Representative Deb Holland's call for a national investigation on the issue. New Mexico state lawmakers are also seeking to create a task force. A bill is making its way in the House, seeks to create the group to look at ways to increase state resources and identify barriers. Bills on missing and murdered Indigenous women are making their way in legislatures in other states, including Utah and Arizona. No Omaha police officers will be convicted in the death of Zachary Bareheels, a mentally ill Native man who was beaten and died while in police custody in Omaha, Nebraska in June 2017. Prosecutors announced Friday they will not move forward with the case against former police officer Ryan McClarty, doubting the office could obtain a guilty verdict, the Omaha World Herald reports. In December, former officer Scotty Payne was acquitted for his involvement. The Native community is expressing outrage that no officers will be held accountable for the death. Tribal leaders and Native advocates have been calling for justice. They've been asking for the city to work on improving relations with Native people. Bareheels was traveling between South Dakota and Oklahoma when he was kicked off the bus and spent hours wandering streets before the officer-involved incident, where he was repeatedly shocked with a taser and punched. The Gila River Indian community in Arizona welcomed state officials and congressional representatives to its community Friday. The tribe opened the MAR 5 Interpretive Trail, which is part of a managed aquifer recharge project. The system captures water and stores it. The tribe, state, and other stakeholders are working on such water management and conservation projects. The Iditarod Sled Dog Race kicked off in Anchorage with the ceremonial start over the weekend. Alaska Native Mushers are among the more than 50 teams racing 1,000 miles to Nome. Pete Kaiser from Bethel was second in the race as of Monday morning. The Yellowstone Art Museum's newest artist-in-residence, Ben Pease, is Crow in Northern Cheyenne, a multimedia artist who strives to make people question what they see in his art. Kayla DeRoche stopped by his studio at the museum in Billings, Montana.
Ben Pease draws a leaping horse on the wall of his studio in black marker. Historically, he explains, Native Americans drew similarly stylized figures on deer or buffalo hides in order to depict dream states or experiences. He says Native American artists eventually started creating ledger art on cast-off papers instead.
There's a number of different stories about not having the right to travel off your land to hunt or fish. And then there's other stories about certain peoples being in confinement and starting ledger art.
And like these artists did in the past, Pease sometimes draws and paints on top of 19th century paper. Many of his pieces are heavily steeped in history and reference Native American experience. Some address indigenous images in American pop culture, others missing and murdered indigenous women and girls. It takes more than a glance to absorb all the elements of his pieces. He says he hopes his art makes people think.
You know, I just want people to walk away with half a question mark in their head.
Pease will spend a year as the Yellowstone Art Museum's artist in residence until November 2019. For National Native News, I'm Kayla DeRoche.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Support by Ramona Farms, offering wholesome and delicious foods from our heirloom crops as our contribution to a better diet for the benefit of all people. We are honored to share our centuries-old farming and culinary traditions online at ramonafarms.com.
Support by the Travois Indian Country Affordable Housing and Economic Development Conference starting April 9th in Miami, Florida. Discounted hotel rooms available through March 15th. Qualifying attendee info at travois.com/annual-conference.
One local man who has battled immigration and customs enforcement officials for the past several years has a check-in with ICE tomorrow, and he's inviting you to come down to the detention center with him. We're very lucky to be joined live in the KBOO studios by Francisco Aguirre, a longtime Oregon community organizer, business owner, and artist who is fighting deportation to his native country of El Salvador. Francisco, we are very happy to have you in KBOO studios today.
Thank you, though, for that opportunity.
Yeah, we appreciate it. Now, you and your supporters have set up a system to make sure that you're not alone when you go to the ICE Center. What is the concern there?
The concern is being me being detained and eventually send it to Tacoma and get deported back to El Salvador, which to me is a death sentence.
Mm-hmm. So explain that a little bit. Based on your experience, what happens when you go to the ICE Center, when you go for your hearing, what happens there?
When we go through a check-in, we're required to bring any information regarding where we live, mm-hmm. Or phone numbers. But it's not just simple like that.
Right.
ICE pick individuals to really give them a hard time. They mistreat people inside the building, but nobody's really watching what is going on inside. For example, in my case, because I stand to defend my rights, they don't like that.
Because you've had some publicity,
yes.
They're going to single you out.
Yes.
Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Wow. So what is the status of your current situation?
I'm undocumented, fighting for staying here, you know, fighting the deportation. I'm applying for political asylum, which it's something not easy. It's become harder and harder every time.
They keep changing the rules.
Yes.
Right, yeah.
Especially with this new administration.
Right, right. So you had mentioned earlier that going back to El Salvador would be a death sentence for you. Can you describe what you might be facing if you went back?
You know, I'd run away from my country because the government and collude with U.S. assassinate my relatives, including my parents. And my son was, 2 years ago, was assassinated after running away from U.S. because he was scared of the government. He thought that they will put him in jail when he heard that they was trying to put me in jail for 22 years just because I crossed the border. They pressed charges of reentry into the country. But we have to think, you know, it's not really fair to mistreat people like that after we force our people to immigrate from more countries and then come into a country who's actually responsible for that, you know, situation in our country and then put our life in danger. After killing all parents, I think something needs to be changed here in U.S.
Absolutely. Well, you've kind of addressed this a little bit, but can you tell us, you know, the conditions and some of the issues that you think people listening should be aware of when it comes to ICE that they may not be aware of?
Yes. ICE, you know, it's an entity that it's creating dangers, not only for undocumented, and we have to be very clear on that. And when I say ICE, we are talking about the specific ERO program that nobody is really talking about.
ERO?
Yes.
Okay.
They focus on identifying, apprehends, and deport undocumented migrants. But really what they are doing right now is more than that. They are destroying families, U.S. citizens. Why? A lot of undocumented people have kids here, mm-hmm. which they are U.S. citizens, and they're forcing them to go to a country and have a miserable life. For example, if they send us to El Salvador with our kids, imagine what will happen to our kids with the gangs members in El Salvador that they pretty active with that corruption, where including police officers are part of the gangs, that you can't trust nobody.
So just like you said, your children might not have parents if the family went back. That would happen probably the first thing, right?
Yes.
Yeah, that's terrible. So you are inviting people to actually come down to your hearing, and this is something you've been doing regularly. So explain why it is you're doing that and how long you've been doing it.
The reason of doing that is because people have the power to make the change. People have the voice and the tools that we need to let us know that that individual, in this case me, Francisco Aguirre, have a lot of support behind, that they willing to stand up and fight against this broken immigration system. And they come in support. Every time that I ask for support, people stand up, you know. Since ICE tried to take me in custody, there is a beautiful moment that it's been going on, and they stand up in my favor, and they've been firm, 100% supporting my case, because they believe that I'm a human being who deserves the right to have a life.
Do you find that, I imagine that this is probably a given, but do you find that the staff and the officers act differently when you have this kind of support
they
there with you?
They definitely do.
They definitely do. In what way?
You know, many times when I go along, there is a couple of times that I went along and they always mistreat me. For example, there was one officer, and I think those officers, they should be removed from there, you know.
When you say they mistreat you, are you talking they physically mistreat you?
They verbally, they use language very inappropriate. For example, they say, Mr. Aguirre, we hope to see you next time in a big kaboom. They call me Mr. Justice when they see people, you know, that they come in to support. They take away my work permit. No reason. I think if I pay for it, I deserve to have it, you know. And according to the immigration law, that's my right, you know. But they do that. So they want you to stay quiet.
And that doesn't happen when you have a group of people there supporting
yes.
you. Now, in the past, you have had people there behind you, and you want to stress that they stay peaceful. Why is that important?
It's very important because we want to throw the message up there that we, the immigrants, we are all about peace. We are a peaceful movement. And not just about Francisco. When I say the immigrants, I'm talking about the rest of the undocumented, you know, community that is up there. We are not a violent people who come to this country to create or generate violence. We fight defending our rights, but 100% peaceful. And there is no group that it's acting with violence represent us. They don't represent us. We are just peace and justice.
Right. And the thing about it is that if the people who come to support you don't remain peaceful, that would give them an excuse to ban them.
Exactly.
Could they do that?
Yes.
They could
yes.
do that. So let's switch gears a little bit here. Do you have information? What do we know about the children in Oregon who've been separated from their parents at the border? Do you have any updated information on that?
A lot of kids are being separated from their parents, and there is the Morrison Child, you know, place where they keep a lot of those kids. But honestly, a lot of kids coming from other states.
Oh, really?
Yes.
Oh, wow.
A lot of kids on those shelters are from a different state that they just move it around the country.
To make it more difficult to find them? Is that, or is it
you know,
resources? Or
that's the way the government make harder for people to find their kids. And I think it's not fair because I went through to that situation with my son, you know, Moses. I wasn't able to find him. Nobody was giving me information. So I think that also need to be changed. They are kids. They are the future, you know, and we're supposed to find the best way to provide, you know, tools that help those kids to grow and be, you know, that change one day.
Are you hearing any reports of poor conditions or abuse of the children in these facilities or here in Oregon in the facility?
Here in Oregon, no, I haven't heard any. But we know what is going on at the border, right, with those kids that they've been abused.
So are there other organizations that are supporting you and others who are in a similar situation to you?
There is a lot of organizations that I cannot talk about because they have to talk, but there is a lot of organizations that they've been supporting, 119 organizations around the country that they stand behind me. But one in a specific that I also represent, I'm a board member of that organization, is the National Day Labor Network, who since the beginning, and they've been really supportive to my case, and they actually are my school. I learn and grow up as an organizer with them.
Oh, that's wonderful. So typically, how many people come out and support you when you have your hearing?
Usually there is from 100 people, sometimes less, and sometimes way more.
100 people.
Yes.
No wonder they behave themselves, right? That's pretty substantial. Good for you. So do others like you have a support network like this who come out and support them? Or
there is very few people, and I think this is a good moment, a good call, you know. I think that support need to be for everybody, not just for a community organizer. And I made that call to every organization, every group, to stand up in favor of everybody, you know. There is a lot of people who need help. I usually go and stay around the ICE building and get in touch with people, you know, and finding out how they can get help, including people who are actually part of the caravan who just crossed the border.
Okay.
Yes.
All right. So how do people find out about when to come down to support folks who are having hearings like you, and also about your hearing? When is that going to happen? Can you give them the details so they can participate?
Yes. So one thing is, for example, if there are people who need help, please get in touch with Unidos con Francisco. We have a Facebook page, and if they get in touch with me, I can help them find a track. And people also who want to help, get in touch with Unidos con Francisco, and I'm probably want to say that we're building a new organization, which we call it VIVA, the Inclusive Migrant Network, which will be helping the migrant community to navigate the system and also learn about their rights.
Are we talking about daily needs help in addition to legal help, or
yes,
one or the other?
Yes,
so both daily needs and mm-hmm. and legal assistance, because I know they would need both. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. All right. So when is your hearing one more time?
It will be March 6th at 10 a.m.
Okay. That is coming up March 6th, 10 a.m. at the ICE building.
Yes,
that's correct.
The detention center here at McAdam Avenue.
Okay, down in the South Waterfront area. You can't miss it. It's a very large white building. I used to work right near there, as a matter of fact. So
yes.
I saw all the protesting and so forth going on.
Yes.
So we really appreciate you being here. Please keep in touch and let us know the outcome of this latest hearing. And we hope folks will get out and support you and others who are in this situation. We appreciate all of your work, Francisco.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Yep. We've been talking with Francisco Aguirre, and he is inviting you to come down and support him tomorrow morning. That is the 6th. So is it tomorrow morning? It's tomorrow morning, isn't it?
It's actually Wednesday.
Wednesday morning. Yeah, it's Wednesday morning at his Immigration and Customs Enforcement check-in. You can connect with him on Facebook at Francisco Aguirre ICE Check-In. That's AGUIRRE, again on Facebook. Stay tuned to the end of this broadcast, by the way. You'll be able to hear more about jail conditions in California for ICE detainees.
Teenagers in Newport Beach, California, over the weekend posted social media images of themselves with red plastic cups arranged in the shape of a swastika. The students appear in the image with their arms held in a Nazi-style salute. Some of the people in the images are believed to be students or recent graduates of Newport Harbor High School, local officials said. The photos were allegedly taken this weekend at a party not affiliated with the school system. Newport Mesa Unified School District officials said they sent a letter to parents on Sunday. In response, many Newport Harbor High School students wore blue to school today in a united stand against hate.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report. At 6, it is Labor Radio, followed by Prison Pipeline at 6:30, where Noel Hanrahan will deliver an update on Mumbia Abu Jamal. Then at 7, Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tonight's weather, it's going to be mostly clear and very, very cold with a low around 27. Breezy, too, with an east-northeast wind 10 to 15 miles per hour. Gusts as high as 25 miles per hour. Tomorrow, lots more sunshine with a high near 44 and dry as a bone. Today in history, John Adams is inaugurated as the second president of the United States of America. And in 1985, the Food and Drug Administration approved a blood test for AIDS infection. That has been used since then for screening all blood donations in the United States. The quote of the day is from the newsroom. Trump's wall needs support. Without support, the wall will fall over.
The fact-checking website Snopes.com has revealed a previously unknown digital media network called Star News Digital Media, Incorporated. This outfit has an explicit strategy to target battleground states with conservative news using websites that appear to represent local newspapers but are really boilerplate copies of each other. Examples you may wish to look up are the Tennessee Star, the Ohio Star, and the Minnesota Sun. Each of these websites has an identical appearance and cover many common stories with little to no actual local news. Star News Digital Media, registered in Delaware, asserts these outlets are for profit. However, these websites contain sparse advertising. There are, however, strong links to political action committees such as the Koch brothers funded Americans for Prosperity and Roving Patriots. You can learn more at Snopes.com in the article titled Hiding in Plain Sight.
9,014 times. That's how many times President Donald Trump has lied since from Election Day through March 3rd, and that's according to the Washington Post. So far in 2019, the president is averaging nearly 22 false claims a day. That is according to the Post's fact-checker database. The president's comments at the Conservative Political Action Conference over the weekend put him over the top and made March 3rd his fourth biggest day for false claims. The Post reported that 104 false claims were made by the president during his speech at Sunday's conference.
A killer tornado hit Alabama yesterday in a storm that indicates Tornado Alley is moving and expanding into the southern states. At least 23 people died in the path of a storm that measured half a mile wide. It was the first time there's ever been a tornado in Lee County, Alabama. A series of tornadoes touched down Sunday across the southeast states. The storm cluster came 6 months after Northern Illinois University researchers reported the Tornado Alley region of the Midwest is moving towards the more populated Midwest and Southeast states. The researchers said this is particularly dangerous because the Southeast region is more densely populated and more residents live in mobile homes. Sunday's tornado measured a wind speed of up to 200 miles per hour.
From our friends at the American Water Works Association, it's This Week in Water, their mission to raise awareness about threats to water supplies in order to protect this most vital resource on which all life depends.
Climate change could make some clouds disappear. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
While many cities and communities across the country are trying to eliminate single-use plastics like straws and cups, a boom in plastics production is occurring along the Ohio River Valley.
Most people don't realize that natural gas is where a lot of plastic manufacturing starts, and there's a lot of natural gas in Pennsylvania, West Virginia, and Ohio.
Where coal and steel once dominated, petrochemicals appear to be the future despite their effects on the climate and ocean pollution.
Inside Climate News reports that an affiliate of Shell Oil is building a massive $6 billion plant in western Pennsylvania to make plastic pellets, which can be turned into anything from bottles to car parts.
The pellets are made from ethane, a natural gas liquid, which is turned into ethylene through a process called cracking. Before processing it, there are plans to store ethane underground below and around the Ohio River.
Shell is not the only one interested. A Chinese firm is moving forward in West Virginia, and a partnership between a Korean and Thai company is soon expected to announce whether they'll build an ethane cracker plant in Ohio.
The new Shell plant alone will emit more than 2 million tons of carbon dioxide a year, which would effectively wipe out all of the carbon reductions that Pittsburgh, 25 miles away, plans to achieve by 2030.
An ingredient that's been used to kill germs may instead be making them stronger and able to survive antibiotics, according to new research.
Triclosan is a chemical added to many household products like mouthwash, clothing, cosmetics, deodorants, body wash, lip gloss, baby toys, and even credit cards in the hopes that it will kill bacteria.
Research from Washington University in St. Louis has found by testing mice that the chemical makes bacteria able to tolerate antibiotics, including those commonly used to treat urinary tract infections.
UTIs are common, as is triclosan. About 75% of adults in the U.S. have detectable levels of the chemical in their urine.
Even before this study, there was some movement to remove triclosan from products. In January, Colgate-Palmolive started selling its popular Total brand of toothpaste without it. Procter & Gamble, the maker of Crest toothpaste, has phased out the use of the chemical in its products. In 2017, the FDA banned the use of triclosan in soaps and hand sanitizers marketed as antimicrobial.
Stratocumulus clouds can appear as lumpy and gray, sitting low in the sky and sometimes producing light rain and drizzle. While they aren't as dramatic as thunderheads that climb tens of thousands of feet into the sky, stratocumulus formations are important for the Earth's atmosphere.
A study published in the journal Nature Geoscience is predicting that these clouds could vanish altogether and not come back if carbon dioxide levels continue to rise at the current pace. Should they disappear, it would heat up the atmosphere even more because they reflect lots of sunlight back into space.
Predicting cloud behavior is difficult, so the researchers used a model to increase the amount of CO2 to 3 times what it is today, at which point the stratocumulus clouds were no longer large reflective sheets.
Clouds have been uncertainties in climate modeling. Matthew Huber of Purdue University told the Washington Post that models may be underestimating their role in future changes.
As rivers run, they naturally take up oxygen from the air and mix it below the surface, which is important for fish and aquatic life. That mixing was threatened recently by a project to deepen and expand the port of Savannah, Georgia.
After being sued by environmental groups, the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers has now built large pumps to force air into the bottom of the Savannah River so that fish can breathe.
The 4 towering metal cones mix water and air just like a small bubbler in a fish tank. The Associated Press reports that the intent is to increase dissolved oxygen in the river for blue crabs, striped bass, and endangered short-nosed sturgeon.
Chris DeSher of the Southern Environmental Law Center said that the machines are similar to placing the river on a respirator and is concerned about the concept of using a mechanical system to reoxygenate it.
The Corps of Engineers must test and prove that the oxygen injection system works before the harbor expansion can proceed.
And finally, you've probably heard the fable about the frog in hot water. As the story goes, if a frog sits in a pot of water that slowly warms, it won't leap out because the temperature change is too slow for it to notice until it's too late and it's boiled to death. While the story has been scientifically debunked, it might serve as a perfect parable for humans and climate change.
A new study shows that as global warming causes more severe and violent weather events, after a couple of years have passed, we're not seeing it as unusual.
Looking at Twitter, researchers led by a team from the University of California, Davis found that people tweeted when temperatures were abnormal for a particular place and time of year, such as a warm March or an unexpectedly freezing winter.
But they found that there were significantly fewer tweets about the weather if those same conditions repeated within a couple of years. people's perceptions of what's normal appeared to be based on experiences from the past 2 to 8 years.
The researchers also wanted to know if extreme weather affected people's moods.
After repeat exposures to historically extreme temperatures, people tweeted less about the weather, but they still expressed negative sentiments overall. Basically, cold or hot conditions seem to make people unhappy and grumpy.
So, like the frog in warming water, the authors say we're getting uncomfortable but may not link it to the cause until it's too late. And as Amber Jorgensen writes in Discover Magazine, if people start normalizing extreme weather, they may develop a warped view of climate change, making it more difficult for policymakers to enact legislation to combat it. This Week in Water is sponsored by the American Water Works Association. Explore new trends in technology at ACE 19, June 9th through 12th in Denver. Learn more at awwaace.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, March 4th, 2019. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. You can call us with your breaking news stories and tips at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Jim Thompson, Maurice Hughes, Carissa Buonch, August Norgren, and Ken Jones. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The interim director of Evening News and Public Affairs is Lisa Loving. KBOO needs more news volunteers. You can sign up by emailing Lisa at kboo.org. That's her email address, actually, Lisa, L-I-S-A, at kboo.org. A podcast and transcript of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Ken Jones.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's everyone's favorite Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it is the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show. At 9 o'clock, Alternative Radio talks about the continuing political crisis in Honduras. At 10 a.m., listen for Flashpoints with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on stage and studio, DeMay talks with award-winning veteran dance artist Linda Austin about her newest original show, Ordinary Devotions. Then at 11:30, it is Art Focus. All of this KBOO programming is made possible by members' support. If you'd like to become a member, all you have to do is go to kboo.fm and click on the button marked Donate. That's kboo.fm and click on Donate. Thank you for listening to KBOO News. I am Michelle Coppola. Good night, Ken.
Good night, Michelle. Good night, Danielle.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Well, if you were just listening to our interview with Francisco Aguirre, you know how important this story is. On In Depth tonight, we are going to be talking about the California Department of Justice issuing a critical report about the state of prisons operated by Immigration Customs Enforcement. KBOO's Heather McCoy spoke with Liz Martinez from the Freedom for Immigrants about what we just learned from this report.
So first, describe how ICE contracts out their jail space within the state of California.
Sure. So basically, most of the contracts in, you know, across the country, not just in California, are through these things called intergovernmental service agreements, and they have to have some sort of local entity, you know, sort of being at the center of the contract. So basically, ICE contracts with some city or a county, and then those cities or counties often end up subcontracting that to a private prison company. Not always, but in many cases that happens. Yeah.
And this is just kind of giving a broad backdrop to the conditions that are found and how this is set up. So before we get to the report, also talk about the bond system in which immigrants have to deal with and how they end up in ICE detention facilities while being held for trial.
Yeah, so not everybody is eligible for bond, but many of those individuals who are, essentially, it's like bail. And so you have to pay at least $1,500 or more, depending on what the immigration judge assigns you as a bond amount or ICE. And that, you know, once you pay it, you're able to be released while still undergoing your immigration case. But, you know, these are very, prohibitively expensive bond amounts. You know, they start at $1,500, but they can be $10,000, $20,000. And for many people, you know, that's just far too much money. And so they have to, you know, they can't afford to pay for their freedom. So many people languish in detention just because of that.
And it's not a normal bail bondsman that they go to because of their undocumented status. Is that still the case?
It's different. The criminal justice system and the immigration detention system are two separate systems. And so some people who, if, for example, they're undocumented and they end up being arrested for, you know, it could be driving under the influence, something like that, you know, they have to go through that system first. And then often they are detained by ICE. And so then they have to, you know, go through that system. And so then sometimes they are eligible for bond, other times they aren't. It just depends on their case and what, you know, the judge decides or ICE decides.
This report that we're going to be talking about just shortly was commissioned by the California Justice Department on the condition in which ICE detainees are being held. It was authorized after AB 103 was passed after reports of death and bad conditions for ICE detainees were reported. This report acts as more like a document that seeks clarity but it doesn't really have like action steps to be followed afterwards. Is that your reading of the document as well? Or
yeah, I mean, there's many ways to read it. It is a very lengthy report, and we're glad that it exists. And just the fact that a state is able to do this is a huge deal, because no other state really does this. You know, because of AB 103, which we consulted on, this is happening. And so, you know, just the fact that we have oversight, that we have a better understanding of our detention facilities is extremely important and not something to be taken for granted. You know, that said, it is important, I think, that we do monitoring. It is crucial, but we do need some sort of action, you know, to hold these facilities accountable, you know, for the abuses they are subjecting thousands of immigrants to every single year. And I think that's where, you know, we need to work on that particular part of the report, and maybe something for future reports to consider.
The report states in one of the opening pages that, quote, when a government takes a person into custody, it must provide for the person's, quote, basic needs, e.g. food, shelter, medical care, and reasonable safety. What does reasonable safety mean in legal terms, and are ICE detainees being held in conditions that meet that standard?
Well, you know, I'm glad you brought that up, because I think, you know, if someone's going to be in the custody of the government, they, like the report says, like you mentioned, they should be able to meet certain standards, very basic standards, right, of food, of health, of safety, and often that's not what we find. Advocates, you know, we've been documenting these kinds of instances for, you know, for years, for decades, and this report confirms a lot of what we have found. But in terms of, you know, safety, it's something as simple as the use of force against immigrants, you know, by the staff, by prison guards, or, you know, if someone is a transgender individual in detention and they are not, you know, sort of treated in a way that, you know, requires more a special sort of treatment because of their LGBT status, they can be, you know, in these situations that are very much unsafe. And so there's a lot of ways that detention facilities in California and nationwide don't provide for those basic needs for immigrants in detention.
When I was volunteering with this group, the LGBT ICE detainees were put into the Santa Ana jail. The city of Santa Ana has revoked that contract. Are they just dispersed throughout the system now?
So, you know, we, when that happened, this was in 2017, before any legislation was passed in regards to AB 103 or the Dignity Not Detention Act. And so what you know, we advocated for the release of all the transgender individuals who were detained at the Santa Ana City Jail because they had what is called like a trans pod, where, you know, transgender individuals could sort of be, you know, separated from the general population, you know, for safety issues and other kinds of issues. But many of them were a few of them were transferred to New Mexico, I believe. But, you know, it is an important thing to talk about in terms of transfers as well as the, you know, abolishing immigration detention. And sort of, you know, when a contract ends, we're always advocating for proper and just closures, that, you know, that people can be released once the contract ends, and that they could, you know, access legal counsel and the community support and all of those kinds of services that they need, you know, in those moments.
The report is wide-ranging and covers due process and proper notice of rules as well. The detainees I worked with, one of the common issues was that although they were from Central America, prison officials just assumed that the signage postings in Spanish was enough of an accommodation, when in fact some of the detainees were indigenous people who only spoke their tribal language with very cursory knowledge of Spanish. This still seems to be an issue. The report talks about Theo Lacey down in Orange County was called out specifically for just Spanish and English signage. Can you speak to the demographics of who are the ICE detainees and the language barriers they face?
Yeah, the report definitely, you know, talks a lot about language barriers, and that's one of the biggest things. You know, we forget that, you know, this is an immigrant-related, you know, system. I mean, not that we forget, but I mean, it's so clear. It's obviously called immigration detention, so you would expect, you know, ICE and prison officials to try to at least, like at the bare minimum, try to provide, you know, material or anything, or have staff that speak the languages that reflect the population in detention, because that's one of the most basic necessities of communication, right? And we found that that's not the case at all, in, you know, across the board. It even mentioned the report at Imperial, the facility in Holtsville near Calexico. There are at least 40% of the population there. They speak Punjabi.
Thank you for listening to KBOO Portland. We'll be back in a moment with our pre-programmed show.
Of the population there, they speak Punjabi, and there's not one single person who speaks Punjabi and part of the staff. And that tells you so much about, you know, how these immigrant jails and prisons, how little they really take into consideration, you know, when it comes to just basic issues like communication. And it is really concerning, because that means that people, you know, if they're having medical issues, they might not be able to report it adequately, because nobody will be able to understand them. Or if they need legal counsel or, you know, legal help, then it's not in their language, so they can't really adequately represent themselves. And just those kinds of things, it creates so many barriers in a system that is, you know, already very, very complex to navigate. So it's an important thing to bring up. Yeah.
What I found so weird was the ICE had these computers, and they were like the legal library, and we were connected to Nexus Lexus, but like that seems on the assumption that A, they know how to use a computer, and B, they speak the language, and C, legal language is hard. Like
extremely hard.
So like, yeah. there just seems to be like this really old computer thrown at the side of the, at like, they're just thrown in the side of the corner and said, you know, this is good enough. Well, they're not guaranteed legal defense. So it just seems, it's like, oh, here's a computer, figure it out.
Right. And one of the things when you go on a stakeholder tour in a facility is they'll always point out their legal libraries and how they have all of these books, and, you know, they try to make it seem like, you know, we're really helping out people here. And that's just not the case. Like, they get maybe 1 or 2 hours max, you know, in the legal libraries. And this is, you know, not every single day. And like you said, it's very, you know, legalese is very hard to understand for just any individual. Imagine someone who doesn't speak the language. And so it really is like this false, you know, like a veneer of legal representation, or, you know, trying to, or of due process. Like, it's really not like that. They have it there, but it doesn't result in like people being actually able to represent themselves. And that's an important thing to consider that many people don't realize, is that people in detention are not, you know, afforded a court-appointed attorney the way that they would be in the criminal justice system. And so more than 80% of people in detention have to, you know, represent themselves.
Yeah. I just want to call out one specific detention facility. It's Yolo Juvenile mm-hmm. County Detention. It's used for detainees that are not adults. Most of the youth there were apprehended crossing the U.S.-Mexico border, were fleeing mm-hmm. trauma and abuse in their country and their home country, only to find themselves suffering trauma and abuse at this facility. The conditions described there are awful. Describe the isolation and some of the stuff that was found in the report.
Definitely. You know, this is what I think the report, you know, just to kind of backtrack a little bit, it went into 10 facilities, but it only did 3 comprehensive reviews. That includes the West County Detention Facility, the Theo Lacy Facility in Orange County, and then, as you mentioned, the Yolo County Juvenile Detention Facility. And you really, you know, once you start going into those details, they are really alarming. And, you know, in terms of Yolo, you know, the kind of use of force that immigrant youth have to deal with, you know, they describe sort of the deployment of chemical agents, which is commonly used, and, you know, as a method of control by detention officers. And then even like at least 9 individuals reporting that they've attempted to commit suicide because of, you know, sort of not only are they coming into a facility with, you know, traumatized because of the things that they've lived through in their home countries and the what they've gone through, like the risks and violence they've dealt with, but then inside detention they're treated that way. And they're even, you know, in the report they sort of highlight different anecdotes that were, you know, from the youth, and saying, you know, like how terrible it is. I think one kid mentioned, I will stop trying to kill myself when I get out of here. You know, that says a lot if you know that we're detaining youth who have fled trauma and abuse and who are being re-traumatized and who are not being taken care of, who are being given, you know, sort of medications or over-medicated. These are like psychotropic medications. And some of the kids even reported like they were not even aware what the medication was, why they were receiving it. And all of these things, you know, if we don't have independent monitoring, we don't know about. Of course, we have attorneys and advocates who've been shining a light on these things, but it helps when you have, you know, someone like the Attorney General confirming this and bringing it, you know, to light, because it just makes it even more official, you know?
Is there really any hope for reform within the system? And does Freedom for Immigrants endorse Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's position of abolishing ICE? We only have about a minute.
Sure. I mean, we are, you know, our main goal is to abolish detention, immigration detention. That's why we're called Freedom for Immigrants. We, you know, believe in our bold statement of freedom for all immigrants. There should be no incarceration. So, I mean, definitely we stand by AOC and her stance. And we think that reform is not the goal. Reform is something like to better conditions in the moment, but the goal is always abolition and community-based alternatives to detention.
If someone wants to get involved with this issue, what can they do in Portland?
Sure. If you're in Portland, you know, you definitely should get involved with any immigrant related groups who are trying to protect immigrants. There's so many. And I, you know, if you want to get involved with Freedom for Immigrants, go to freedomforimmigrants.org. You can always volunteer remotely. You can, you know, donate. You know, we are, you know, volunteer based most of, you know, our work. And we, you know, just share our stories, share the stories of other immigrants, you know, go to your local immigrant jail and visit and people and really understand what's happening, you know, inform yourself.
My guest has been Liz Martinez. She's with freedomfromimmigrants.org. Thank you for joining us.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Building Bridges to Sustainability. On Friday, March 8th, from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at PCC Cascade Campus in Portland. Building Bridges to Sustainability features keynote speakers, presentations, and breakout sessions where participants will have opportunities to gain insights to equity, economic opportunity, and social justice while shaping a culture of sustainability. Again, that's Building Bridges to Sustainability, Friday, March 8th from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. at the Portland Community College Cascade Campus, 705 Northeast Killingsworth Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time chief engineer. Applications are due by midnight on Monday, March 4th to 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214, or by emailing engineerhire@kboo.fm. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regards to the minimum qualifications and by answering the following question: why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, for more information, go to kboo.fm/engineer2019.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of a live performance by Antonio Rey on Thursday, March 7th from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. at the Old Church Concert Hall in Portland. Antonio Rey is one of the leading flamenco guitarists of Spain today. Rey will be a flamenco dancer and singer, Mara Rey.